Hello, everyone. Just kidding. This is Chris Powers, and I want to thank you for joining me on the Fort Podcast. This show is an open-ended discussion and journey telling the stories of leaders, founders, CEOs, and people making an impact through business, investing, and entrepreneurship. We take an unconventional approach that leans into thoughts and ideas that aren't often publicly discussed. We'd love to hear from you at thefortpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again.
Chris Powers is the founder and CEO of Fort Capital. All opinions expressed by Chris and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Fort Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for real estate or investment decisions.
Hey guys, it's Chris. Thanks for tuning into the Fort. Excited to have Jason on with me for the third time this year. We go deep into a lot of what we're working on here at Fort and a fund that we'll be raising later this year. Excited for y'all to listen. Thanks. Episode 3, I've got Jason Baxter with me today. We've got a few topics we want to go over, so we'll jump right into it. We have something at Fort Capital called CORE, which is C-O-R, Cost Reduction, Overhead Management, Revenue Generation. This was kind of the brainchild of Jason. And today I want to go over what it means for our business, but also how businesses get bloated really quick and why cutting costs and saving money, although it sounds like a really easy topic and things that all businesses should do, how it kind of can get out of whack and how you need to keep yourself in check. So let's go.
Let's do it.
How did CORE come to be and how did you kind of think about it?
Well, yeah, luckily we're in my past life at David Weekley, this was a huge part of the process of making sure that the company was profitable. And one of those things was a version of this that they used, but it comes out of when things aren't good, right? These type of things tend to just slide. When things are great, people aren't watching the bottom line the way they should because the money's coming in faster than it's going out the door. So it's hard to focus on that when there's so many opportunities. The minute those opportunities start to slow down, all of a sudden those become the most important things. And so coming here to Fort Capital and thinking, you know, 5 years ago when we were just talking about what we wanted to do and grow, it was very quick to see how you get into that mindset very fast on we're not really watching everything we're spending because we're so focused on growth. And so it just dawned on me that while we're doing this, we can go ahead and build this into the culture today, make it part of what we do. It's just, it's here. It's not what, something we focus on when things are bad. It's something we focus on even when things are good.
Right.
And so that way, whenever things are bad, it's just built into the system.
Yep.
And so over the last year, we just put an initiative in place to basically focus on CORE, and that's what we've been doing.
Yeah. I mean, we highlight monthly team members that have achieved something through CORE. So that could be something as small as, you know, we have lunch delivered for the team a couple days a week, and we figured out we were paying X amount to the delivery guy and we could do it differently.
Yep.
And that saved us X amount a week. We figured out really quickly just by changing the delivery method, we would save $2,500 a year on lunch. So it's little things all the way to the really big things. We've saved over $350,000 across our company's overhead in literally spending the last 3.5 weeks really focused on it.
Right.
And that doesn't mean we've just gotten rid of doing things. It means we have a lot of technology subscriptions. Has anybody audited them lately? Are we bloated? How much are we spending on snacks and food? We're moving to a vending machine method and that creates more ownership. Just a lot of things. So I guess what were some of the easy low-hanging fruit things that almost any business could think about when they're trying to go in and cut overhead?
Yeah. I mean, the easiest stuff is the stuff you just mentioned. There's all the little things that companies do that are just part of the day, water and things like that. And when they're just, it's a given, people start to treat it. They start to just think of it as not as a benefit, as something that's like a right to them. And not that it, almost like it could never go away.
Right.
And it's just here. And so you have to sort of shift that mindset of even those little things of water and not being wasteful and using cups. And we've done that stuff. And you can't spend too much time on that. But if you build the culture enough, that's the low-hanging fruit where people are just aware of, let's not be wasteful with this so that we can keep this thing that we have at the company, which is these little free benefits that we have. Then you start to just get into the more P&L items. So this is where, if you've ever had to manage a P&L statement, a profit and loss all the way down the company, and you have to go through it every single month and you look at those line items, it just becomes daunting of the dollars that are the little things every month. And so establishing budgets and going through them is great every year, but what you really should be doing is looking at every one of those and finding ways to cut every single month. Not cut things that are good, but cut the waste.
Right.
And so the low-hanging fruit are just the things around the office that are just the subscription-based stuff like you mentioned. You sign up for these things. Nobody thinks about every year renegotiating those. Calling the company and saying, hey, we've grown, we're doing this. Are there any other options that you have out there today? Maybe they have a new plan that they offer. Nobody does those things on an annual basis. So we just have a process that we're setting up that just makes that a given.
Like, I think we noticed, and we're just going to be fully transparent, like this is how our business is run, and the good, the bad, the ugly. But in a lot of small businesses, I hear this from other people, but I know ours is, we have all these subscriptions, whether it's to technology or whether it's to something that's being delivered pretty regularly, like water or anything of that nature. Well, what we noticed was there wasn't one person that was doing all the subscriptions. Like, you might have Shayna buy this on at this point in time, and then I bought this subscription at this point in time. And there's all these subscriptions that over time you might not even be accountable for anymore because you've moved roles or you've moved on to a different team or you're not working at the company anymore. Right. But nobody's kind of watching that subscription or knew exactly why we had bought that subscription. And so I know what we're doing is we're merging all the subscriptions so that somebody's accountable for them. There's an alert every year. And again, that stuff sounds so simple, but if you're running a small business, you might ask yourself, like, what all subscriptions are you a part of? Who's managing them? And are they all dialed into your current needs at your company?
Right. It was the simple thing of just, they lived on 5 or 6 different credit card accounts, essentially. Same, you know, we have a corporate account, but they live in different people's worlds. And by just consolidating those, so they were literally on one statement, clearly all technology that the person responsible for technology can review every single month. That sounds like a no-brainer, but that stuff just, even in the best companies, there's no system to that. It just happens.
Yep.
And so we're just trying to get that stuff fixed right now while we can.
So CORE is a word, an acronym that you hear around the office often. It's something that we're really pushing into the culture so that people are CORE thinkers. Because it just can't fall on one person's plate to be cost conscious, but also look for revenue opportunities. One of the cool things we did this year, that we're just getting really started learning, but we're seeing a ton of opportunity. We're hiring a gentleman named Kyle Pope that has been instrumental to helping us watch costs, not only on our corporate overhead, but on a lot of our real estate projects. Kyle came to us from a really big home builder where he was a purchasing analyst. And so will you just talk a little bit more about what he does and how it's currently valuable and the things that we're seeing we can do in the future?
Yeah. So in our business, the Fort Capital business is different than a traditional, say, construction or development company. We're an investment company. So a lot of times companies like ours don't focus on things such as purchasing or buying products or how can we save in the things we're investing in. And so we took a little different approach from our background in construction and development and said, how could we apply that to these assets that we're buying and investing in? Because we still have CapEx dollars. We still have things that we're doing and just managing. And even the office stuff we talked about before, if we had this person here that was focused on nothing but making sure that we had the best cost across everything we do, no matter what it is, specifically in construction, that would just be revenue generated directly to the bottom line. There's no easier way to get revenue than just to reduce your cost.
Right.
Your revenue goes up because you're still making the same amount of money on that thing. Just reduce your cost and the profit goes up. And so Kyle's job is to come in and anything that we look at, anything we do, examples in industrial building, if we're going to redo the roof, we're going to get bids from contractors like anybody else would do. And Kyle's job is to go make sure that is the best cost we can get, calculate the square footage, look at the products, research the market, find the best alternative to what is being offered to us, and make sure that we are doing the absolute best thing for the asset and the profit of the deal.
Yep.
And so that is a service that Fort Capital now can provide to its investors that otherwise we wouldn't have. So we look at it as a win-win across the board. Our company is able to generate more revenue. The investors are able to make a higher profit return on the investment. It's something that I think a lot of investment firms in the future will probably start to pay attention to a little bit better, because it all boils back to operating world-class, best-in-class in everything we do.
And it's one of those things that we've made a decision. We don't want to be in the constructing business. We don't want to be the actual contractor, but the maybe the relationships that we're creating with third-party contractors or the contracts we're signing with them is, look, you're going to go out, you're going to build this, you're going to bid all this stuff, but these are certain line items that we're going to bid along with you. And as long as we can provide a contractor or a vendor that meets your requirement, we're going to almost be working with your team to help this project save costs. Because we realized over a long time that although it might seem like through different incentives that you can give to contractors where, hey, if you can save us money, we'll give you X percentage of savings, you really learn over time that they're built for speed, and having to get an extra bid or go out of their way to not use one of their relationships, which tends to be like one of their buddies, that creates more time. The longer the project goes on, any savings they would have created might get eaten up because contractors have fixed overhead that's being spent no matter if it's done in 12 months or 15 months. So this gave us a way to help them still move quickly, but watch costs also. And
we can leverage the size of our portfolio now. So we've assembled a very large portfolio of similar type assets that now when we go out to bid a roof for an industrial building, we actually have the relationship with the roofing company now. We don't have to necessarily go to a general contractor to then go get these bids. And by having a purchasing analyst here, that they can negotiate across a larger portfolio to make sure that we get the best cost and leverage that for the future, for future projects. So this is a way to sort of solve the one-off project problem of trying to negotiate with a contractor or a roofer,
right,
to get the best deal when you can only really talk about this one deal. You're just one of many in the market. But when you're talking about everything you have as a company, you can start to use that as leverage. In addition to when we start to have the relationships more and more with these larger contractors that we can go to direct to leverage the portfolio, we can start to incentivize with rebates. So the more and more work that we give them on a larger scale, we start to get those rebates. And this is normal market stuff that a lot of companies do, but companies like ours that are our size do not do these things. These are things that tend to start to happen when the company gets so big, they have to do these things in order to keep their profit and cost in line. And we're able to do this right now as a small company, and I think it's a huge advantage.
Yep, it is a huge advantage. Next topic was Culture Index. So we've talked about it a lot. It's been on some of our social media. Wanted to talk about it with you in particular because you have labeled it as a superpower that you believe you now have. Why is Culture Index become a superpower for you?
Well, I mean, it's starting to feel like that. It's not, obviously, it's something that you just learn over time. You just get better and better of understanding of what the information is that you have and how to use it. So it's not a it's not a superpower in itself, in the sense of the survey that the people take and the information that comes back is relative to whoever reads it. But understanding the information that it's trying to give you and if you are able to ingest that and then apply it to people as you're talking to them and understand where they might be coming from, you can start to evaluate what is happening in that conversation much deeper than you could before. And so in terms of a superpower, I can now take the information that I've learned and start to communicate with somebody in a way that is the most impactful to them, that is allows me to try to create the most incentive to help them achieve what it is that they're trying to achieve. Where before,
can you give like an example of how maybe you might talk to somebody differently than you used to?
Well, I mean, I think there's some key components to the Culture Index that there's the key traits that are the dominant traits in that. And understanding the major difference between somebody with this dominant trait versus this dominant trait on opposite ends of the spectrum. It's very easy to see when you're in a meeting and it starts to feel like that there is a little bit of a conflict or we're not understanding each other. And what tends to happen is we just stick to our guns and we just run full speed the opposite direction because this is who I am and that's who they are. Having the power and knowing that, now I have the choice to say, I understand where they're coming from. Let me adapt to this situation a little bit to get the most out of it for both of us. And hopefully over time, they recognize that now I'm understanding of them and their understanding of me. So the more we both learn who we are as individuals, the communication starts to become much more impactful and we're not wasting our time. Right. 'Cause at the end of the day, that's when I think of superpower, I think of it as we're not wasting time not communicating properly.
Right. I think we learned a ton. Like, I mean, even a little example of, I tend to send emails to people that are not very long. They're very short. They're usually bullet points.
Right.
And that can come across to somebody who's built to be more social as, I don't know if the word is short. I don't even know how you would describe it. 'Cause to me, that seems like the most logical thing to do is just communicate the message, very efficient. But then there would be people that would say, I always took those as like, maybe you were upset or what. And, but then after learning about those people's profiles, those are the same people that would write me back a 5-paragraph email. How you doing? Da, da, da. There's just different ends of the social spectrum. There's some people that are just not built to, you know, be overly social. They think more in logics and data and facts compared to another end of the spectrum where people are thinking on emotion and past experiences. And just knowing that, I now, when I see an email like that, know where it's coming from. And those people hearing from me don't look at that any longer as like, I wonder if there's something wrong, if I said something wrong. It's more like, oh, this is how he communicates.
Absolutely. And it's helped us as a company as a whole, me as an individual, but the company as a whole, just in how we understand the importance of these different personality types within the company and how they fit into the role that they're in and the future of the company. We did this little graphic that we did in our new vision deck that we built just to sort of talk to the company about the future and what we're working on. And in that, we took we put every person on there almost like an orbit with a circle, and the size of their circle was how long they had been here. So you could easily see the length of tenure, but we also color coded them to people that focus on today and people that tend to focus on tomorrow. And that's two distinct traits that are identified in the culture index. And we just recognize that is super important, because if you don't have those two things, you cannot build a company. You cannot be successful. Chris and I both are people that tend to focus on tomorrow, and we run really fast, and we tend to leave a big wake behind us of things that need to get done. But that's also what drives this company forward in the growth. So we appreciate and we understand that that's valuable and that's super important. But as important, equally as important, are the people that can execute everything that we're doing every single day. And those people are finishers. Those people are designed, they're built more to, they're a little more organized, a little more perfection, a little more of those things, which you and I don't have as much of. And it doesn't mean that each of these individuals can't do all of these things. We're right. All capable of doing all these things. What the culture index allows us to do is, it's not to say this is who you are, you can't do these things. It just says this is what you're best at.
Right.
This is, if you focus on these things, you are going to be more successful, most likely.
Right.
Chris and I both have done, and many people in the company have, even today, are doing things that aren't exactly who we are, because that's what it takes to get done. And we're very successful at it. So it's not that you can't do it or you can't do it for a long time, but over time, if you can align those dots to match what you are doing every day, most like who you are, the chance for success is exponential, and that's what we're trying to do.
Yep. All right, next topic is FOS. So wanted to get a little further into FOS and some things we've been working on. We talked about it on the last episode, but things have changed quite a bit. So FOS to Fort Capital is the Fort Operating System. It is a technology platform that we've been building for the last year. We've actually hired a full-time person, Greg Adams, who's he's a damn genius, and we can maybe talk a little bit about that. But I wanted to just have a conversation on what we have going on there and why it's impactful to our business and what's coming.
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody listening to this could agree that technology it's a given, and it's not going anywhere. It is what it is. And so we from the very beginning have embraced the need, and Chris and I are both into technology. And so we've always adapted and moved forward in that world. And about a year ago, when we started talking about how could we start to build our own platform or start to do things in a way that was scalable for us and that we could add on to and grow our platform. And we ended up meeting the guys down at Boxer and getting Stemmons. That has evolved into what we now call FOS, which is the Ford Operating System, which is a combination of the things that we got from Stemmons and the things that we're working on with Greg, which is starting to scale in a way that I don't even think you and I could have projected even 6 months ago.
Right.
And so it's things that we wanted to do, but it's things we didn't know were as possible. So it's really the automation of things that we do every day. It's the systematic approach to not having to the human time to do all these things. And code can do so many things. It's there's a great little book on the robot revolution and that's coming. And people think of robots that are being built right now as like, oh, that's the future. But people don't realize, like, we're already halfway through that revolution, and those robots are all the ones and zero calculators that live in all of our computers, and they're doing most of the work in the world right now. They're doing far more work than we do as humans in terms of calculating, crunching, sending data all day, every day. Those are all little robots inside all these computers. And so what we recognize is we can take advantage of that in every aspect of what we're doing and be smarter than the people that are doing what we do as a living or yep. for a living in real estate specifically or in investing specifically. But that's scaling into the other things that we're thinking about, the other types of investments that we want to make. And we're setting our platform up so that the FOS, our operating system, allows us to do a lot more than just invest. Yeah. We can operate just about anything. We can invest in just about anything, and we can do it quicker and more systematically and better than most.
With an incredible resource of data.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, it's all about data. There's tons of articles actually that just came out this week. It's, you know, oil and gas for as long as we've been alive has been the most valuable thing. Because it's the resource that the whole world needs to move forward at all times. And it still is. Like yeah. in terms of the world still needs it. It's not going anywhere. But in terms of value, there's a lot of articles out now that are showing that data is more valuable than oil and gas. And if that's already happening right now, the use of data the way it is today is such a it's just now getting to the point where we can actually use it. And we have exponentially more data than we actually can even use at the moment. We've been able to collect it for a long time now. Use it is a whole nother thing. And so now with machine learning and the big data warehouses that are available now and our ability to aggregate the data and write the code to go find the things that we want to write are just, they've never been at this scale. And so now we're able to use the data like we never have before, which makes it so valuable because to solve the problems that we couldn't solve even 6 months ago, every month it's speeding up that you'll be able to solve these problems that used to take months or years. You can solve them in minutes now.
Talk a little bit about how, like, Watson, like how we're using Watson and the plan there. And I can talk on it too. It doesn't have to be me just asking you.
But. No, for sure. I mean, I think we're both excited about, we're obviously not unique in this regard. There's lots of companies that are exploiting what is now free, not free, but services that you can pay for out there with the machine learning with Google or Amazon or IBM's Watson. But you're just able to capture data now that is out there for anyone to get. And you can tell the system what you're looking for, what is a successful thing, what is a good thing, what is an outcome that you're trying to achieve. And if you show that thing enough what a good outcome is, it will start to tell you what the next good outcome is.
Yep.
And so for us, that's a simple way to put it, but it still takes this layer of, as a real estate investment company, we have to be able to identify the things that are successful, that we say are successful. We have to find a way to identify those in a very systematic way that is repeatable. and then we can show it how we did it. And that is the part that becomes proprietary. So we feel like that if we can find a better way to aggregate our data, to sort our data, and spot the things that we think are the best, show the machine learning tool that, it will start to go find those things for us and say, here's one.
Yep.
Here's another one. Here's another one. And so that takes time, but not as much time as you would think.
Yep.
And so for us, we think we're building a tool. We know we're building a tool that allows us to basically go find the next best investments at a scale and faster than most people can.
And what we're not outsourcing our thinking, in that we just will put no more thought. We'll just let Watson or artificial intelligence give us the answer. But what we're saying is we're coming into this office every day and only looking at the 1,000 opportunities that fit at least a certain criteria. Absolutely. Or the 100, so that how much time is wasted on deals that we'll never do, we probably would have never done, but because we're doing it through the old fashioned way of, you know, searching the internet, driving out and looking at a property, flying to Houston to look, there are so many other little components that could be added into a data set that say, here are the properties that are constantly meeting the criteria that y'all have outlined. It's still our job, one, to have the criteria, but then two, also having somebody saying, have you thought about it this way? Or why aren't you using this criteria?
Right.
And when I'm talking about criteria, I'm not talking about the very simple things like how big is a building, or is it in the industrial park that's the most famous in DFW? Like, those are the obvious. I'm talking about which industrial buildings are within 2 miles of a zoning case that just went into mixed use in an area that hadn't seen any mixed use in 5 years. I mean, things that show growth patterns and how growth happens. So Watson can go to any city across the country, look at all the public data on zoning cases. We can pull all the zoning files, then run a quick link. Please show us all industrial buildings within 1 mile of this certain type of zoning case, and da 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 da. And oh, by the way, we don't have to ask it to do that once a month. It does it while we sleep. It does it at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. And oop, we just got an email. Here's a property that met this unbelievably niche criteria of things that you're looking for.
Right.
And thinking like that really spawned off a question that we started asking ourselves at the beginning of the year, which was, how could we do business in more cities around the country without having to open up a ton of offices, right, and hire a lot of people? And how could we be more relevant and get up to speed in a market without having to hire, you know, again, open 15 offices across the country in every city we want to be in? And so we kind of use a lot that one question, how can we be in more cities quicker, as a guiding light to backfilling into what technology can we create that helps us, you know, give us an advantage in a city that we wouldn't have had before.
Yeah. The old school way of thinking is that you would just, you know, you'd get in that city, find a market expert, or you'd become a market expert, and you would just hit the ground and boots on the ground. And there's still value there without a doubt, but that is the difference. That's the game changer in data, and being able to take that data and actually do something with it to go spot these opportunities that even those people that are boots on the ground that are smart, they can't see everything.
Right.
Data can see everything. It can see things that you can't. So when you combine those two things, you get that data, you go into that market with this knowledge that you otherwise wouldn't have had, then you call that best broker in the market and say, hey, what do you think?
Yep.
That's just validating at that point.
Yep.
But we'll be able to spot it long before we ever talk to that person. And there's a good chance we might be able to spot something they wouldn't have seen. And then just because they don't know about it doesn't mean it's not right. Then that's for us to investigate further. But I think it's the future. I think this is a race to the top, and in terms of being able to utilize these tools to go spot good opportunities. And I think we're only maybe 5 to 7, 10 years away before a lot of groups have this type of thing. So the way I look at it is, we're doing it now because if we don't, we will be left behind. But we're also doing it ahead of many or most, so that we're already at the next edge of whatever's coming that we can't even see yet, while everyone else is just getting on board with the things we're doing today. And so this just goes back to sort of our mentality and our thoughts on how we grow the company, and that we're just always staying as far ahead as we possibly can with our thoughts and what we're doing.
It's like, how do you take simple ideas like going into a new market and just saying, how do we make this 100 times better? And the truth is, for anybody listening to this, these technology resources don't cost billions of dollars. They don't even cost millions or thousands of dollars. They are in the hundreds of dollars, but it is the art of knowing what you're trying to achieve and then being able to piecemeal certain things together to where it works kind of in harmony. So as much as we're building for things that could take us outside of Fort Worth, help give us new information, that's tied into a platform that's helping just run the operations of our company day to day better, to where we take a lot of the guessing out of work. I think what we realized through Stimmons and our relationship with Andrew and Justin was how much time people spend every day, whether they know it or not, like wondering if that email they sent to that person got read and if they're doing anything about it. And so they follow up, hey, did you get my email? Oh no, I didn't get it. What did it say? Oh, well here, let me send it again. How much of like little communications like that waste so much people's time? And we're creating a system to where thoughts can't get lost in translation. Like they live in the system, they're attached to people. So rather than send an email out into the abyss, we send cases to people, and a case is another word for like a to-do or an action item that lives not only on their to-do list, but also on a list of things that I gave out to do. So I can constantly monitor both things.
Nothing gets lost. And that's something, a note that I had that, you know, we have talked a lot about Naval Ravikant's podcast, his little segments and the time component. When I think about all the things that we've been talking about, it's all about speed and execution and operation, but it all comes back to, we waste a ton of time. He had that quote on there that we basically waste time with a death of 1,000 cuts. We literally are just slowly dying with our execution every day because we waste all these little moments of what we could be focused on, the most important thing, the most impactful thing. But instead we get caught up in the meetings and the follow-up and the little running around the office and checking in with people and doing all the things that we feel like we're working, but really we're just being little busybodies and everybody's running around doing these little things all day that aren't really having a big impact. And so when I think of that, how we're using technology and the things we're doing is we're not trying to take away the human interaction. We're actually trying to increase it, but increase it in the most impactful way, not wasting time of the little, let's go have a 1-hour meeting with no agenda and let's sit down and just think that we're magically going to solve whatever problems that we came in that meeting to discuss with no outcome or agenda set up in place to go in and actually execute on it. So we end up just sitting there wasting an hour's time. And then when we talk about, like, we go have a meeting and there's 5 and 6 and 7 people in that meeting, and you realize there's 2 or 3 people in that meeting that are half zoned in, half zoned out. People's minds start to drift. 2 people take over. 1 person's got an agenda, another one. If you're having a meeting with 5 or 6 people, almost always it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Almost always.
Unless it's one person talking and a lot of people listening.
Right. I mean, there's always the team meeting. I'm going to tell everybody what's going on. That's different. But if you're going in to try to solve a problem or get stuff done in a company and you have 5 or 6 people in the meeting, you're probably wasting your time.
I think I have it written right there, what he said in that same, most meetings should be phone calls, most phone calls should be emails, and most emails should be text messages.
Yeah, and even better way to say it is, if somebody asks you for a meeting, immediately respond to them and say, can we do this over email?
Yeah.
And if someone emails you and says, hey, they start a conversation, or someone says, can we get on a phone call, you immediately say, is there possible we could do this through email?
Yeah.
And if someone's emailing you and you're back and forth, hey, could we just do this through text, right? If the shorter that you can make those interactions to make them the most impactful, you get to the same end result. You just actually get there quicker and you don't waste the time. And that's what we're trying to figure out, is how do we not waste those moments so that the moments that we have with people, the individual, is much more impactful and creative.
Yeah.
And it's the things we're talking about right now. How do we push the ball forward?
Yeah.
I think you and I can agree we would much rather just sit here and talk about the future and all the cool things that we just said every day and not waste time in the meeting. And then I think if you can automate a lot of this, you can actually do that.
And if we can automate it, we can get into lots of different things besides real estate, because at the end of the day, it's all just a function of communication.
Absolutely.
Providing a platform where people can spend more times on the things that they're good at and not more time wondering why the email they sent last week hasn't been responded to.
Yeah.
And I think people really underestimate themselves. I would challenge you throughout your next work week to catch yourself every time you're wondering what something, if something else is getting done that you thought should be getting done. It might be getting done, but you're still wondering if it is. It might not be getting done. Even worse, now you got to double down your time, and you might find that you spend more than half your week just thinking about the things that you hope are getting done, whether they are, whether they aren't.
Absolutely.
And I got to give Stemmons a ton of credit for helping kind of show that vision and show how formatting an operating system through technology could help solve a lot of that.
Right. And it does, it's twofold what we've done with that is obviously it takes all that time waste out of it, of the communication back and forth. Everybody knows where everything stands between everybody at all times, which is super valuable. But at the same time, that information is being collected in a very organized, systematic way, which is becoming usable, actionable data that we have in our system now. Where before, all those conversations, all those emails, all that stuff back and forth, hey, you do this, I'm going to do this, I'll follow up with this, all that just died and disappeared. Now that is all getting captured in a way that we can actually use it. Data that we can actually figure out where we're wasting time, how we can get better, how we can communicate better, how we can solve problems better. So it's solving a lot of problems. So one thing that we talked about more recently is sticking to our core values when we're looking at investments. And we've been talking about raising a fund, and we have very clear strategies that we think are impactful right now that we think are good investments. But over the last, I would say 6 to 7 months, we have been running very fast, and we've become more and more sophisticated with how we look at our investments and how we underwrite them and all the variables that we look at. And what it feels like when you're doing that is you feel like you're getting smarter. You feel like you're getting better tools to make better decisions. And you start offering on more deals because now we've used the same models and criteria over and over again. And so we start to believe that if we plug these numbers into this magical box, that the outcome is good, that we can invest that money and it's going to be successful. And it's not that that can't happen. It does happen all the time, every day. But what happens over time is that's those people that get burnt because everybody is running towards the same thing, which is what the market said last. What were rents? What are my projections? And everybody always projects indefinitely that everything is going one way up and to the right. And so we just in questioning ourselves and in a couple of deals that we have had recently under contract and things that we've decided not to buy, it's shined a light on this. How did we get to this decision to almost buy this thing that we realized that we probably shouldn't buy? And it caused me specifically, and I know we've talked about it a lot with the investment group, on what led us down that path. What did we not think about? What did we not miss? And it led me to this thought that again came from Naval's podcast, but he doesn't talk about it in the way that it made me think about, which was this false precision idea, which is the sort of the short definition of that is when exact numbers are used for notions that cannot be expressed in exact terms. And so when you think about real estate, we do that every single time we look at a deal. We say, well, we think rent's going to go up. We think we can get this
much. Has there ever been a deal that someone thought rent would go down or stay flat?
Right, never. And so we take these assumptions, right? We take these variables and we say, well, rent's going to continue to go up because the market's good. We say, we can project a 7 cap on this exit because that's what we think is safe in 5 years. How the hell would we know that? How would anybody know that? No one knows that. So they just project. And that's a variable that they say, okay, we'll add these variables. We'll add these assumptions on when this person's going to leave this space. And so there's going to be downtime. So that's another variable. So now we've got 3 variables. And then we're going to say, and when that person leaves, we're going to offer them $30 in TI. But there's only a 75% chance of that. Okay, so there's now 3 more variables. So now we're up to 6 variables. We're not even scratching the surface to how many variables are in a model for real estate. So when you take that false precision idea and you add it to like our real estate deal, then you get this. If a model, in a model, the more estimated variables you have, the greater error in the model. Literally, that's what false precision is. You think by adding more and more variables that you're getting to a more refined decision. What you're actually doing is getting further and further away from the actual result, because it's more and more guesses. And the more and more guesses that you have, there's no way you can be more and more guesses and be more and more accurate. It just, and this is all backed by science. If you do the numbers, you actually get further and further away from the accuracy. And so we do this every day, and I'm sitting here thinking, well, that's dumb, because we rely on these. And then you think of somebody like Warren Buffett, who literally sticks to these like three fundamental values that he uses for everything.
And margin of safety being the first one.
Right.
And like I talked about this with Hunter yesterday. If the building we're in right now is worth $5.5 million, maybe 5.6, we're listing it soon.
I was going to say six.
If I told you, would you buy this building for $1? You'd say, yep. I'd say, do you need to know anything else? You'd say, nope, I'll meet you at the title company.
Yep.
If I said $2, you'd say, yep, I'll see you at the title. If I said $1 million, you'd say, yep, do you need to know anything else? No. I don't need to know one other thing. I'll see you at the title company. What if it's $4 million? Can you send me the rent roll? And can you let me know when it was built? And I need to do a roof inspection. Okay.
Yeah.
What about $5 million? I need the rent roll. Do you think the tenants will stay?
Who are the tenants?
Who are the tenants? Can I see all your past invoices? Yeah. Can I blah, blah, blah? Okay, what about 5.5? Can I see every little detail? And really, to riff off what you said, the more questions that you have to ask to get to a yes, it's proving either two things. One, you're just unsophisticated about the industry you're in. Because even if I said this building's $1 million, if you had just moved in from, you know, some other country and had never done business, asking that you need a rent roll isn't a dumb question. You might just not know enough. Or number two, you are headed to something with a lot less margin of safety and a ton more room for error. And so right. The same building at $1 that you don't have to think for a second, when I put the $5 million number on it, you have to ask 50 questions. It's not bad to ask 50 questions, but more what you're telling yourself is, I'm headed towards an area where the room for error is much, much, much less. And I would argue, and this is what Warren Buffett, he doesn't use models. He right. says that he can usually make a decision in a matter of hours, if not minutes.
Right.
Now, he has done a lot of reading and prep work leading into a lot of this, but the decisions he makes, he's so confident on, because he's like, I have so much room to be wrong on a few little variables it won't matter.
Because, and that's exactly where I was headed, because you're far better off picking the one to two the biggest, most impactful variables in that decision that you know to be true for yourself and that the market values most.
Right.
If you can identify what those things are, and I say one to two, it could be three, but the major things that are the most impactful that the market perceives as the most value, all the other little things that you're projecting in that model should be irrelevant. You should be able to look in our world and go, what's the price per foot of the dirt? What is the replacement cost? Like the big factors, like are we buying it? That's how you're getting to that example in our building. You don't have to know if somebody offers $1 million or if somebody's selling this building for $1 million that it costs a hell of a lot more than that to build it, right? We just know. And so those fundamentals, and then, you know, when what you just said about Warren, like he knows those things. Well, he knows those things because over decades of learning, and it's not because he got advice from 1,000 people. The more and more advice you get, if you
it's the same thing,
right? If you get enough advice from enough people, it just cancels the zero,
right?
So you have to be able to listen to that advice, learn from that advice, and then use your own judgment against it. So basically, you reject all advice, but listen to it, and then make your own judgment. And if you have those one or two variables that you're looking for at all times, you should be able to make a judgment in a snap second because you know what the right answer is almost always. And so when I'm just thinking about how we're valuing what we're doing every day and the way we look at investments, we just have to hold ourselves true to the things that we know are valuable today, that we know make good investments. And if we stick to that, then we'll execute on the plan that we're about to do.
Yep. And trying to get back to like a one. We just recently made our quick model, which is red light, green light. It's right. A few lines in Excel. And if you can't get a green light out of that,
you shouldn't
just don't keep going. Like if you need to add five more pages into the model to make it a green light, it goes back to you're really just telling yourself like there isn't any room for error in this deal.
Right. Absolutely.
And it's also the longer time horizon that you are willing to give yourself, the more you don't have to focus on every little variable. If right. your window is a year, then a lot of stuff has to go right.
Right.
To get to the end of the year and have created enough value to get out. Again, if your time horizon is 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you're just not worried about where rents are headed next year.
No.
If you're buying with an outlook of a long time, not saying that every investment is a long time, but if your deal only works because you're going to own it a year, be prepared for some headache if not everything goes perfect. Right. And look, it might. We've had a lot of deals that worked out great in a year.
Absolutely.
We've had a lot that didn't work out in the first year like we thought, but 3 years later, we're better than we thought.
Right. And the real key to that is that if you buy based on those true fundamentals, even within a year, you should be okay. Because if you really bought below, things could change, but you still should be in a good spot,
right.
even within a year. But the way we really headed down that path about false precision was the idea that we're moving more towards a fund structure and not the way we've been doing business for a long time.
Yeah. So we have done business, and not that we will never do business like this again, but we have done business on a deal-by-deal basis. Every deal is looked at through its own microscope, usually under general themes, but through its own microscope with its own set of investors. And we've amassed a portfolio of 40 plus entities and investments that all have 40 K-1s and 40 sets of investors and 40 reports that need to go out each month. And the amount of work that we do internally just to kind of administratively manage what we've done, if you just looked at the business and said, well, how much of that would be cut out if you just all wrap that up into one larger partnership? That operated, that alone from a core perspective, cost reduction, overhead management, revenue generation, would cut out an extreme amount of cost. And cost isn't necessarily always just a real dollars. It is real dollars. It's people's time. Mm-hmm. If you can get back 10,000 human hours into your business, you just got back $1.5 million in overhead. And so for the first time, and we've really struggled with wanting to be a fund for a long time because one of our core values is just being entrepreneurial and being able to move quick. And I think part of that's just been misguided about how all funds tend to be. But our goal is to create a better vehicle where we can move quicker, make decisions quicker, and administratively manage it better and create situations where leveraging a portfolio of assets ultimately does better for the capital at work than a bunch of individual assets that are selling to kind of smaller buyers. So if we can offer something that a larger buyer would maybe want to purchase, it benefits the whole portfolio in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the fund structure is something that we've avoided for a long time because we wanted more control. But what we realized over time is that it began
to control us.
Right. It actually becomes the controlling factor. So now going back to the technology discussion is we're really have built our way into being a company that's all about speed. And speed now, because we have fine-tuned all the other things that allow you to operate on speed, operation, execution, finding deals, closing deals, all the things that it takes to go do the thing we do, we've gotten really good at that. So now being able to move to a fund structure allows us to execute on this thing that we've built much more efficiently than the way that we're doing it now. So we've sort of built a platform where we can move really quickly, and now we're limited by the way that we've structured it.
Right.
So what this allows us to do is just take that next leap.
I think one of the biggest things I've learned, no matter what industry it's in, business, anything, is especially the buyers that can make the life of the seller very easy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not just offering a big price. Time, the amount you require from them, a lot of transactions become very stressful, and you have these companies that have 1,000 mandates they have to check before they can make it. You never know the deal is going to get done till the last day.
Yeah.
And by the time it's done, the relationship between the buyer and the seller really isn't a harmonious one, even though the buyer might have just given you a lot of money or something. They bought what you had to sell. Is building something where we can create more simple transactions, ones where people can trust them more. They happen quicker, not quicker because we don't do any due diligence and don't check our, but quicker because we've built a technology system that allows us to get through the laborious part of doing a deal really quick, get our information, and be able to show up to closing. And there will always be a place in the market for a buyer that can just buy, get a better opportunity at a cheaper cost simply by building a mousetrap that makes a situation easier for a seller.
Yep.
And we're going to do that. The fund helps us do that.
Right. It allows to move quicker and still provide the same service and results that we're providing to our investors.
Having capital ready to go is probably something I've learned over the last couple years, how important that actually is.
Right. And it's a choice. You know, there's tons of companies. We could operate the way that we're operating now for the rest of time. And it's fine. Some companies, that's, and even for us, if we didn't have the ambition and the ideas and the scale that we have in our mind in terms of technology, this wouldn't matter as much. But when you're doing these other things that allow you to move really quickly, this other thing that allows you, that forces you to move slow, can't exist, and it becomes the painful thing. And so it's just a choice that we've made. It's not right for everybody, but we know it's right for us.
Well, and if you're just thinking like, okay, well, moving quickly, does that create more risk in the system? Is not really, because if the things you're going to do to research a deal or to do due diligence on a deal are going to happen anyway, and they're happening quickly, there's still more hours left in the day. So what are you going to do? You have more time to think, more time to look at more opportunities and find the right one. That extra time should be used in a way that puts you at less risk,
right?
Not more risk.
I want to use the time to refine algorithms and research and refine our data sets. Yep. I mean, that's really what we should be focused our time on, is how do we get smarter at identifying and using the tools and resources as opposed to doing it the way that we used
to. Or reading, or reading, just whatever learning. It could be. So speed on the things that are process driven are just the parts of the business that go along with it, and more time for really just thinking. I mean, I just know it's something that I've been thinking, or I've been trying to do more of, is literally not just reading a book for a couple hours or reading in my office for 2 or 3 hours. Used to be feel more like I don't have much going on. I need to put some stuff on my calendar. And I realize I leave the office way happier if I've had 2 hours to read in my office than if I had 2 more hours of meetings or phone calls or checking a spreadsheet or whatever it may be. So
the 2 hours you get to read and think, anybody really, but I know you or myself specifically, those 2 hours can be the most valuable time of the entire week.
They can change your life.
They literally can. So the
coming reviewing up, a meeting isn't going to maybe a meeting every now and again. Reviewing a spreadsheet isn't going to change your life. But every now and again, when you read something, you could look at the world completely different.
Right.
Good and bad, but usually good. I think one of the things that we have learned is that bigger isn't always better.
Mm-hmm.
Being profitable is better, not just being bigger. And it's really easy to get wrapped up in, okay, we did this size deal, now we got to do this size deal. And you usually justify that by economies of scale.
Mm-hmm.
But again, going back to like even core, you kind of can lose sight of also, but it's bigger and it has economies of scale, but it's not more profitable.
Right.
And I think that's a trap that a lot of people get into. There's more dollars at stake. People are pushing money around a lot more. But it's not always the smartest. Mm-hmm. And there's moments in time where it works. And so admittedly, probably something we learned this year was really trying to chase whales. One, it burns a lot of energy. You're playing a whole different game against people that are playing a whole different game than a smaller business. But they're not necessarily more profitable either. So where I think we have found a really great niche within real estate is that $5 to $15 or $25 million space, where the institutions are not usually dipping down that low, and the smaller folks are not really going up that high, and it provides kind of this middle market, if you want to call it, of opportunities that still have quite a bit of value because they haven't been professionally managed. They've probably been owned for a long period of time or owned by a family or an individual. They're easier to finance. They usually have better returns. And your pool of, you know, big dollar capital chasing them is much less. I mean, you start getting above $25 million, and now all of a sudden you're dealing with, you know, a Blackstone that has, I don't even know, 10, 20, 30, I don't even know, $100 billion that they're going after stuff with.
Right.
That's just a whole different ballgame. And so I think really getting back to narrowing in on focusing on that sweet spot gives us back our competitive advantage. Not that we lost it, but now we at least have lost the idea that we have to go above that, right. Which actually is freeing, because I think for the first half of the year, we really wanted a whale of a deal. And not that we wouldn't do it, but it's got to be the right deal, profitable, and that typically isn't going to happen in any other way than just finding that diamond in the rough.
Right. And it's the smaller B-class industrial, I think we've talked about that story and the value of that sort of asset class and the locations and the fact that there's a ton of individual owners and all the aspects that make it an attractive investment right now in the market. It is a good reason why we would be looking at it. But then you take our speed and what we're able to do and the technology that we're placing on top of it to be able to spot these assets in a way that is much more efficient and quicker than anybody else off market and just go direct to the seller, to be able to aggregate that stuff so that the larger institution can come buy those things, because that's one thing that we're starting to see, which I like to think that we were just ahead of the curve and seeing this. I think we're a little bit lucky in it. I don't know if that we saw that it would happen this quick, but the larger institutional players are now starting to come back into this space of this smaller B class, but not the way that we're doing it. They still cannot buy that 5 to 15, but they can buy 70, 100, $200 million portfolio of those smaller assets, which we see as a huge value add to us and to our investors. And so for us to be able to go aggregate this stuff in a very rapid way, put together these pools of assets, and then be able to sell them to these larger institutions, that's what they want. They're looking for groups like us that are able to go do this and execute on these acquisitions that they just, one, don't have the manpower or the time to do it. They're not set up for it, and we are. So we can actually take this space and go play in it now. I look at it a lot like the multifamily space 6-7 years ago, where you, and it's still happening today, so it's still well underway, but people were buying up these B-class multifamily all over the country, and they put money into them, and then they aggregate these into these portfolios, and they sell them to these large institutions that buy 5, 6, 7 assets at a time for $150 million. That model is a brilliant model, because the institutions, they're dying for that, and they just need these people to go execute on these business plans and get these assets operating the right way so that they can get them into these funds. And I think that there's a huge runway here for the B-class industrial in this 5 to say $20, $25 million range to be able to go aggregate, because there's just literally thousands and thousands of buildings across the country that are just ripe to be aggregated and accumulated into these portfolios.
Yep. And like you said, I mean, it goes back to their economies of scale. Like, they can't buy a $5 million building, but they can buy $25 million buildings as long as it happens in one transaction.
Right.
It's a lot of what you've seen in the oil and gas industry and the consolidation of a lot of smaller players going and leasing up a bunch of acreage and then flipping it to one of the big boys. It's the same thing. I mean, the big real estate giants have so much money right now that they have to put to work.
Right.
That there's an opportunity. And so, just, you know, again, identifying that as like an objective of like, how do we aggregate quicker under assets that we would want to own ourselves long term and put those together. Mm-hmm. We're either left with a great portfolio of our own, or we're also added this whole nother value component, which is a whole new buyer that's entered the market for it with, you know, different hurdle rates and return rates, and they're getting debt at who even knows right now. We have negative yields right now.
Right.
So And again, that's just learning. I mean, I couldn't sit here and say a year ago we were thinking that. It's amazing just how much can happen in a year when you kind of stay in the game.
Yep. Just get smarter every day.
Yep. All right. Hey everyone, it's Chris here again. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes and leave a 5-star rating or write a quick review. You can also email us at thefortpodcast@gmail.com with your thoughts and comments. Thanks again, and I'll see you on the next episode.